Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president of Remote Review with Inspired Review, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bites. We're alongside the Honorable Judge John Facciola, retired U.S. Magistrate Judge for the United States District Court of the District of Columbia. We aim to offer information, insights, and ideas about e-discovery innovation from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever you want to download it, which is whenever you hit play on your device. Today we have an interesting show, which is really a hot topic these days, the new federal rules, and specifically the impact of the rules in 26, Rule 26 on proportionality. And before we started this series, Judge Facciola and I were debating if there needs to be another show on these rules, given the lengthy discussions that have been had about them at CLE programs across the country to date. But you know, not everyone can afford the time and expense to attend a CLE program where the speakers we have on this show and others like it, give their time to talk at. And since our show is free, we decided to put out two shows. We did one with Judge Grimm last month on sanctions and preservation, and this is the second one we're doing on with Judge LaPorte and Judge Grewal. So, the Honorable Elizabeth LaPorte, our first guest, is a federal United States Magistrate Judge for the Northern District of California, and she serves on the Board of Governors for the Northern Chapter, California Chapter of the Association of Business Trial Lawyers, and Executive Committee of the Litigation Section of the Bar Association of San Francisco. She's also a judicial observer for the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Discovery, or Electronic Document Retention and Production, and she wrote an excellent law review article we'll be talking about, with Jonathan Redgrave for the Federal Bar Law Review, entitled A Practical Guide to Achieving Proportionality under the New Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 26, which I would encourage everyone to go download if you're interested in this topic. It's available for free at the Federal Bar Association
website. And if I could just
thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
The Federal Courts Law Review.
Oh, yes.
Courts
okay.
Law Review. It's the Magistrate Judges Association Electronic Law Journal.
Great. The Honorable Paul Grewal is also from the Federal United States Magistrate Court Judge from the Northern District of California and joins us as our second guest. And he, like Judge LaPorte, is a frequent speaker nationally on e-discovery topics and is active within the Sedona Conference, has authored many well-regarded opinions. The high-profile Apple versus Samsung patent case, a lot of people talk about in the e-discovery world, and he's also issued two opinions we might touch on today, which deal with proportionality. Interestingly, I thought this was funny. At Georgetown this past year, Judge Grewal has a really wonderful sense of humor. He gave the funniest opening to any question I've ever heard in an e-discovery conference when he was on the floor, not on the panel, and there were 7-8 well-regarded judges, including Judge LaPorte, sitting at the podium this year at the Georgetown Advanced e-Discovery Conference, and he made a reference to the JV team of judges not at the podium, which drew a huge laugh from the audience. And I, although Judge LaPorte was on the varsity panel and Judge Facciola on our show was moderating the varsity panel, I might add, Judge Grewal, you were on the varsity panel the year before, and I'm sure you'll be on it again next year.
Good morning. It's great to talk to you all. I think the British and their soccer fans have a term for that called relegation. So maybe there's an opportunity to move up to the Premier League at some point.
Well, I don't know about the San Francisco Giants, but the Nationals open spring training tomorrow. So we're going to be taking a hard look at you, Grewal, during spring training.
put me in, coach.
All right.
I spent eight, 9 years trying to speak at Georgetown, so I can appreciate relegation. I finally spoke this year, and the tickets entered the judicial world, too. It just shows what a great conference it is. But anyway, thanks for joining us here. I'm going to assume the role of moderator on this show and try to stay out of the way of all the judges on the show, including my co-moderator, Judge Facciola, as they discuss really this important new e-discovery rule and proportionality and anything else they want to add in the new rule. So let's start the show. Before we start, Judge Facciola, you had an anecdotal story about proportionality that we talked about that maybe you want to share that'll sort of set the stage for why this is important.
Yesterday, I spoke to the Attorney General's Office of the District of Columbia and about the new rules. And I had, when I was a judge, handled a particular case in which they represented the defendants. And the case went on for 10 years, seven of which were involved in preliminary matters, mostly discovery, which I handled. At one point, the district court judge and I pulled out the docket sheet and realized that together we had issued 43 opinions and orders. Yesterday, just before I began to speak, one of the lawyers, whom I know well, said, "Judge, I've got something to tell you." I said, "What is it?" He said, "That case just settled." So it settled after 10 years of litigation and 7 years of discovery. So if that case doesn't emphasize the importance of proportionality, I can't think of one that does.
Unbelievable. Well, you were involved with some of the rulemaking process, so sort of as an overview. You want to talk about how we got to where we are today?
Yes. The 206 amendments to the federal rules were the first set of rules that dealt specifically with electronically stored information and its consequences in certain distinct areas, such as privilege, production, and format. Starting in 2006, however, there was still a concern that discovery in general, particularly electronic stored discovery, was still out of hand. And that culminated in a very significant conference at Duke University Law School in 2010 called the Duke Conference. If our viewers do nothing else today, looking up the proceedings of that conference and the wonderful materials it produced would be a good use of their time. The 2010 Duke Conference was preceded by a lot of committee work, and I served on the committee chaired by Greg Joseph with Judge Shinlin and John Barquette, some other folks, which dealt with one aspect of the rules, which was a new sanction rule. We made our report, recommended such a rule. From the Duke Conference, there was yielded other post-conference activities, and I attended one in Dallas, which was very interesting in light of our topic. It was primarily corporate counsel, defense counsel in many cases involving discovery, and they argued using a lot of statistics that were quite interesting that the disproportion of discovery was leading to horrific problems for American corporations in two senses, in the sense that they had to do so much to get things together, but also in the sense that they'd have to preserve so much for fear of being sanctioned. So the central theme of these exercises was to think about proportionality in terms of the general approach to discovery and specifically as to production. That ended my involvement except for monitoring the what the committee was doing through Sedona and other fora, often with Liz and Paul. And then that really was the conclusion of my responsibility. But I do recall at certain times speaking about the drafts that we had as we proceeded. It was quite a long and arduous process. The sanction rule itself went through very different forms. So that was my involvement.
So before we jump into the new rules, let's get the impressions from Judge Grewal and Judge Laporte on sort of the need for really attacking these issues again. I mean, if you look at Rule 1, and right in Rule 1, the need for just, speedy, and inexpensive resolutions of cases, with language like that already embedded in the federal rules, Judge Grewal, why do you think we needed to insert proportionality concepts directly into Rule 26? Hadn't we done enough already?
Well, I think we have done a lot already, certainly compared to the way discovery was managed before the 06 amendments and even going further back to 93. But I do think that the 2015 amendments were important. You ask about Rule 1. Well, before the amendments in December of 2015, Rule 1 didn't specifically speak to parties as well as courts having an obligation to secure just, speedy, and inexpensive determinations in every case. So I think it is worth noting and hopefully will have some impact that now parties are on fair notice that this isn't just the judge's problem. It's the parties as well as their counsel's problem. As far as Rule 26 goes, I think it's fair to say that we now have explicit direction as to how and under what circumstances these proportionality factors need to be considered. Most magistrate and district judges, I think it's fair to say, were giving thought to these issues, these criteria, even under the pre-2015 amendments. But now with explicit language in the rule itself, I think you're going to see a greater consistency from court to court and judge to judge, and a greater consistency in case to case, even before a single judge, in applying these factors.
So Judge LaPorte, you recently wrote an excellent law review article with Jonathan Redgrave on proportionality. That article went through some of the factors you identified which caused proportionality to languish as principle in most litigation. You want to talk about that?
Well, I think that unfortunately, despite proportionality being in the rules already prior to these amendments, it wasn't prominent enough, and even if it was, parties weren't paying enough attention to it. And so frequently, and Paul's probably had the same experience, the parties either wouldn't mention it at all and just talk in kind of very, very general terms about that's irrelevant, or no, it's relevant, that's too much, that's too little, and not get much beyond that. Whereas trying to figure out what is proportional discovery that's justified for the needs of the case, and on the one hand allows someone to prove their case on the merits, on the other hand doesn't turn into just what we always have called irrelevant fishing expeditions at a time when there were plenty of fish in the ocean and you could spend all your money doing that rather than resolving the case, it just was languishing. And the problem is that people have just would seize on at most one or two factors, such as perhaps the amount at stake but nothing else, or perhaps their view that it was hard to find the data, but not go through all the relevant factors and not then use those to come up with some better alternative. So I think that's been a frustration, and I think the hope of at least the judiciary and the people who worked so hard on making these rules changes is that there will be a better focus. And one of the efforts to make that actually happen and achieve more consistency and success in applying proportionality is ongoing efforts of continuing legal education like this one to everybody involved. And certainly the judiciary is doing a lot of focus for judges on these rules changes and how to apply them.
This is
okay.
I'm sorry. I just to go back to Liz and Jonathan's article, there are two elements of it that are terribly useful. The first one is a matrix of factors that counsel should consider, and then 10 practical tips. What I think Liz and Jonathan are communicating to us is this is not an all or nothing proposition. When I was a judge, most of the briefs I got were pretty useless. They said, and I love this, discovery is broadly construed. That was about it.
Right.
And as my father used to say, John, don't trust the generalization, including this one. Okay? So we are commended by this article and by Paul's opinions to think about these things as factors which have to be weighed against us. And the second thing we have to think about, again, Liz underlines this point, is that it's no longer useful to show up and throw at the court cases from long ago that antedate these rules by decades. So broad statements in older cases about how broad discovery is and so forth are no longer terribly useful. They haven't survived this dramatic shift in emphasis.
I think that's a terribly important point you're making, John, because the sad reality I can report, at least from my chambers, is that even now, several months after the amendments were enacted or became effective in December of last year, I'm still getting quotes from those old musty cases you're referring to. And you're right. They don't help us very much under this new regime.
You know, one of the observations I'll share on this is sometimes lawyers tend to go back to form documents and
yeah.
when they prepare something.
Yeah.
I remember
judges too, unfortunately.
Kicking off a case, I had a lawyer apologize that we couldn't train our review team yet because he was trying to find a form coding protocol. And for since you don't get involved in the trenches, what a coding protocol is the instructions of the review team on what they're supposed to be looking for, which is unique to the case. So there would not be a form coding protocol
yeah.
that you could use. It's your story.
To underline that point that Paul just made and you just made, in a conference in New York where we discussed the rules with Judge Peck and Judge Moss, Judge Francis, and some other folks, the judges turned to one of the lawyers who's on the panel and said, okay, in light of what you've heard today, please tell me when you go back to your office, what are the first five things you're going to throw out? Number one on the list was all that boilerplate that's in a word processing system that has been used in a rote fashion. And I think that's really very important. When I spoke to these lawyers yesterday, I said, there are new tools here. They're wonderfully useful tools. And if you don't use them, well, shame on you. And that's really, I think, what this is all about.
Yeah, and
I would add, insist on you using them, set a good example, and then the other side using them and engage in a meaningful dialogue. As Paul mentioned, Rule 1 now is amended to make explicit that the parties share the duty with the court for trying to achieve a balance between just, speedy, and inexpensive. And in the commentary on the changes that are in the rules, parties are encouraged to cooperate in discovery so that it's not all or nothing is not at all what the rules call for. What they call for is a much more nuanced application of the various factors to achieve proportionality, and that requires a discussion. Not you don't get any of this because it's overbroad, or we need everything because we don't trust you and it's somehow reasonably calculated to lead to admissible evidence language, which is now taken out of the rules. It was never really meant to be a kind of automatic open sesame to getting everything you could possibly think of, but it had been sometimes interpreted or at least invoked that way. And go through the factors, as you mentioned, the matrix, discuss them at the first before the first case management conference and as time goes on, and talk about what custodians you're going to look for and perhaps different amounts of discovery for depending on their importance, what databases, et cetera. And that's what we want to see. And I mean, I just, as Paul said, I still see parties come in with these kind of highly general loggerheads of all or nothing, and I talk to them, and there's much better ways to approach it. But they've already gone through a motion and spent a lot of time and money on a dispute in a way that was completely non-productive. Then I get I've asked for a letter update, and now they're finally talking about what they should have been talking about all along.
Paul,
go ahead.
I have a question for Paul, if I may, following up on that.
Sure.
Paul, do you find very useful briefs that talk to you about burdens and who has the burden of this and who has the burden of that?
Well, if it's an esoteric setting or a very unique posture, maybe. But look, at the end of the day, I think I'm not unique in that most magistrate judges and district judges grappling with these issues just want to figure out what's going to be practical here, what's going to be workable among the parties, and that's really how I want to spend my time, especially at oral argument. If I'm going to the trouble and frankly cost of setting a hearing on a motion like this, if we have a motion at all, if it's something more than just a letter brief or a discussion on the phone, then I really want to figure out what the facts are, and I'd rather spend my time focused on that issue, or those issues rather, than on allocating burdens and assignments. I appreciate, that we're all bound by those burdens of persuasion and proof, but in a discovery setting, when you're talking about proportionate production of data, I would rather focus on the harder questions than those ones.
Yeah, I would just quote, if I could, in Liz and Jonathan's article, there are 10 tips. And number 9 is marvelous. Quotes, do not get caught up in an academic dispute regarding burden of proving proportionality, as courts will expect that each side of the dispute will have something to contribute, although not necessarily equally, and the most reasonable position will likely prevail. And that was the point I think Paul was just making. This is the advisory committee notes make it quite clear, attempting to apply proportionality is supposed to be a collective exercise involving the lawyers and the judge. So standing on one side of the room and yelling burden across the room doesn't advance anybody's interests.
I think that's exactly right.
Yes, I agree. And the notes further make clear that there's no automatic one side or the other having the burden of proving proportionality or disproving it. It's according to their ability. So typically, although not always, the requesting party, they should at a minimum know why something is relevant, but they may not know very much, if anything, about the burden, and the party that would be producing the information knows a lot more about the burden. But there's all sorts of variations on that. The court's going to be looking for common sense. There's something that you ought to be able to contribute on this and then do so.
Now, since we talked about lawyer behavior and the pace of change, why don't we jump right into these two very interesting decisions which Judge Grewal authored. So we're not going to ask Judge Grewal about these cases because they are active, but they do give us some real context on real disputes and how a court interjected proportionality analysis directly into the proceedings. So why don't I start with you, Judge LaPorte, if you want to talk a little bit about Corning Optical and Solid versus Solid Ink, which was frankly an amazing case. If you want to take the reins on this one and talk about it a little bit.
Well, I that's a case in which Judge Grewal said you can't just punt at the beginning of the case and say, I know nothing about what my damages are, in this case in a patent case, because I'm going to need this and that and the other thing, and I'll just feed them all to my experts eventually, and then I'll come up with something towards the end of the case. You've got to get started, as the federal rules actually require, with initial disclosures. And moreover, it's even more vital now that, and it should have been before, we have to take that into account as one of the factors in proportionality. What is the value of the case? So, of course, you may need to supplement that. We have rules for that as time goes by. But at the very least, start with what you can do. As opposed to saying, well, I can't do it perfectly now, therefore I don't have to do anything. I hope it's stated a lot more elegantly than that, but I think that's kind of boiling it down to where it comes out.
And I would add, this is the very heart of what we're trying to accomplish. We have to consider the amount in controversy, but if we take the ad damnum clause from the complaint, that'll always be $1 million, and the answer will be 30 cents. Why Paul's opinion is so important, it reminds us that we can't play that game anymore. In every case, we can't get it perfectly, but we can come close to a better approximation of what is truly in controversy in terms of amount. And as Paul points out, unless we do that, we literally will have nothing to talk about because we don't have an anchor. So for counsel, this applies not only to a complicated patent case, but let us say to an employment case. How much money did this person lose by virtue of not getting this promotion? Has that impacted on her ability to get additional promotions? If she is going to make a claim of emotional distress, is that going to be bothered on psychiatric and psychological testimony? Can we get some sense of what this case is all about? What is the potential for fees that might be generated by these? So we have to be very pragmatic and practical with these numbers. Numbers matter. Paul, I know you can't talk about the case, but this notion of numbers matter is something that always troubled me. It was like pulling teeth to get out of counsel what this case was actually worth.
Well, yeah, speaking generally, it's something that I struggle with too. I think all of us and all or nearly all of our colleagues appreciate, you know, litigating these cases, it's a tough job, and figuring out what the case is worth is a tough job. But that is the job of counsel in these matters, to come forward with good faith estimates and, you know, best effort approximations, you know, considering where the case is at and what discovery has been provided. And I think most judges are going to be forgiving of a good faith effort if it turns out not to be accurate. What we're all less forgiving of, perhaps, is no effort being made at all. And that's what I think we're trying to get across.
I think that's right. And I think it's useful, at the very least, to know what ballpark we're in or what universe. You know, you may not need precision at the beginning of the case of exactly what it's worth, and there's going to be some dispute about that even towards the end of the case, probably. But at least you can get started on getting your hands around where it falls.
You know, another aspect of that is these discussions, and particularly if the court is engaged, may expose some fallacious reasoning that should be corrected quickly. For example, my circuit was pretty tough on getting, in an employment cases, damages for it that looked into the future, any appreciable distance, such as a claim that by virtue of not getting this promotion, I won't get another promotion for another 10 years, and trying to approximate that. So in many cases, counsel will project these damages out over a long term. And it turns out that that's fallacious as a matter of law. So I always found it very valuable to find those things. So we, as Liz says, we all would get at least on the same universe.
Well, there was a second decision that was recently written in January. I think January 13th, the opinion came out, and Jaleed Science versus Merck, where broad production requests were made for disproportionate discovery. And Judge Fasciola, you want to talk about that case at all?
Well, I'm going to do some with some reluctance. I don't know about Paul and Liz, but the only reason I went to law school is because they promised me there would be no math.
Well, yeah.
Can I interject a quick funny story? I wasn't going to do it in the last part about math. So I have a dual degree. I went to Carnegie Mellon and got my MBA, which is a hardcore quant program, and went to law school at University of Pittsburgh, had a dual degree program. And I remember when we got to torts, the class stopped when we got to a formula by Judge Posner on how to define what was reasonable conduct. And I can't remember the exact variables, but there were only a couple. And it took 2 days to go through this formula. And I was telling one of my Carnegie Mellon classmates about this, and they laughed. And they specifically said, I remember this well, how do they come up with damages if they can't quantify that? And I think about the conversation we're having today, and it's like the conversation was just yesterday. Do they see seven zeros in a number or something? I mean, where do the numbers come from? But anyway, go ahead, Judge Fasciola.
This is a patent case, and it involves the production by one of the parties of certain information in the form of the contents of certain tubes. And the question presented by the party was whether the theoretical possibility that there was an additional information as to the contents of the tubes and other information bearing on the case being in the possession of the defendants was enough to justify discovery. So we are dealing with discovery that is not based on actual fact, but on the theoretical possibility that A, the other side is lying, and B, they're hiding the ball. And armed with nothing more than that, they came before Paul with a motion to compel. But he pointed out that the party seeking the information, and first of all, offered no real evidence that the representation as to the contents of these tubes was incorrect, let alone fraudulent. And the second thing was that the theoretical possibility that there was other information could not possibly satisfy the requirement of proportionality. To the contrary, it's the converse of proportionality, since it's based on nothing more than the theoretical possibility that there must be something out there that they're not showing, even though there's no evidence that that is true. Also, the information sought bore no relationship whatever to the claim or defense in the case, which is now the standard. And in a lovely line, Paul said, this leaves the party dealing with it, trying to get information that has nothing to do with the case. Quotes, this is untenable. It would be like requiring General Motors to produce discovery on Buicks and Chevys in a patent case about Cadillacs. because they simply happen to all be cards, to be cars. And I think that's a marvelous way to put that, and it is, unfortunately, an almost generic description of what we often saw in discovery before the amendment to these rules. A, well, there's got to be something more out there they haven't given me. And B, it might theoretically have something to do with this case, so let me have it. So it's something like an employment case demanding the personnel records of everybody who works in the company to see if they have theoretically been subject to some form of discrimination. And this opinion is a magnificent example of how we are going to have to go from that to a more realistic assessment of what's at stake and what is the true significance of the information being demanded.
So, Judge Grewal, is part of the – we were talking earlier about changing lawyer behavior and how slow lawyers are to change even in the face of new rules. So is part of the answer of reining in discovery a firm judicial bar which really forces proportionality discussions to the forefront?
I think that's a large part of the answer, but I think it's important to get the question right. And I would frame the question slightly differently. I think reining in discovery is important where the discovery that's being requested is overbroad, but there's an equally important problem which I think the proportionality factors speak to, which is getting the right discovery out in an efficient way. And I think, you know, to the extent there is legitimate, in my view anyway, concern that these factors are going to be used and ratcheted up one way against parties, typically plaintiffs looking for evidence from defendants, which are largely corporations in these types of cases, I don't share that pessimistic view. I think as to each of these goals, you know, getting the right discovery out and avoiding the wrong discovery from burying everyone in the case, I think getting a conversation going sooner is key. It won't necessarily solve the problem, but I think our chances of succeeding without that early conversation with a lot of court input and encouragement is an essential factor to achieving that kind of success.
Yes, I would agree with what Paul just said, and it is true that the people who tend to be the most worried tend to be the cases where the plaintiff is suing over employment or civil rights or tort, perhaps an accident, and they have relatively little information compared to the defendant whom they're suing. And so they are worried that they'll be cut off from being able to try their case on the merits. But the rules specifically took those issues into account and said, and one of the explicit factors that should be considered and is in the matrix is the party's relative access to information. And if you read the notes, it's still contemplated that that's not a reason why one party doesn't, there's no automatic bar to getting discovery because you're not both producing the same amount and it's causing one side to have to spend more money on it than the other. And it's not an automatic reason for cost shifting. And another factor being the importance of the issues at stake in this action. And a lot of commentary has pointed out that one of the ways to figure that out can be, is there an asymmetrical fee shifting provision whereby if the plaintiff prevails, the plaintiff is almost automatically entitled to fees, and if the defendant is, only if the case is somewhat unusual or frivolous or something of that nature. So in other words, Congress wrote the statute to encourage that kind of litigation, so that may also weigh in. So all these factors come into account, and I think if they're properly applied, I share Paul's optimism. On the other hand, it does require that everyone apply these in good faith and consider all the factors that are relevant in any particular case.
You know, one of my favorite Law Review articles is now quite old. It was written by Paul and Liz's former colleague, Judge Brazil, Magistrate Judge Brazil. He wrote it in 1978, and there were being considered certain rules changes. And he did a remarkable job of digging out the history going back to 1938 and the works of the giants of civil procedure like Jerome Barron and Charles Clark. Mm. And he made the startling discovery that those people who drafted the rules never really thought that discovery would be adversarial. I thought it would be a cooperative process. I show you what I have, you show me what we have, and we go to trial. The notion that has happened to me, that I would spend 7 years of my judicial life on discovery in a single quick case, I'm sure would have had the poor men absolutely marveling at what had happened. So maybe this is an attempt. Maybe it's the last attempt we will get to go back to the inception of the rules and see if we can create a different way of doing this. I remember when the Sedona Conference promulgated the cooperation on the proclamation on cooperation. I devoted primarily to showing that there was no inconsistency between cooperation and transparency and a lawyer's ethical abilities. I saw that my dear friend Richard Berman would get emails describing the proclamation as Richard's folly, and my all-time favorite comment, over my dead body. So this adversarial system has a hold on lawyers, but I hope they appreciate that there is absolutely no inconsistency between being a good advocate and being a cooperative one. Pick your fights. And as my experience showed again and again, it's shocking how much money we fight about over stuff that turns out to be not very important at all.
Yeah.
Well, if getting the judiciary more actively involved in enforcing these rules in an area which I accept with your criticism or commentary on the question that you need fair and proportionate discovery, not necessarily less discovery, but proportionate discovery. How do we actually help get these ideas out through the judiciary? If there are any thoughts, and I know I was going to ask you this question, Judge Laporte, but I know Judge Facciola, you're involved with the judiciary, the Magistrate Center, and Judge Grewal, I also noted in your background, which I didn't introduce, that you're also involved with that as well. So you, I think, all got views on this. What are your views on getting, education out to judges on these types of concepts?
Well, this is Facciola. I think we're doing a pretty good job. Liz and I did a program for a group called EDI. They sponsored it through the FJC, and we spent the better part of 2 days on these. We were able to take 50 judges. We understand 150 applied. I've participated in another program, which is now going around the country. I don't know if it's made the West Coast yet. But Judge Rosenthal and Professor Gensler of Oklahoma, that's sponsored by the Duke Center for Judicial Studies. They are going from courthouse to courthouse, educating people. Again, we had standing room only at that program, which was at the courthouse. So there has been remarkable attendance. I did a webinar earlier this week, which had 300 participations. So I'm very hopeful that we're talking to the right people. And I'm certainly very, very hopeful that the judges are getting it. Certainly the initial opinions that we are seeing show a consciousness of how significant these rules are.
Yes, both Paul and I participated in one of those same programs at our courthouse just a couple of weeks ago, and it was sold out full, 300 to 400 people, there was a lot of interest in it.
I think the other piece of this that I'm hopeful about, but it's going to take some work for sure, is that in individual cases, I think counsel, clients are going to have to work with judges to understand how to apply these rules and what makes sense for a particular case. And so what I would like to see, and what I'm hopeful that we will see, is a much more robust, engaged discussion at the Rule 16 conference, at the initial case management conference. That's really, I think, the best opportunity for all of the parties to this topic to have a real conversation about how we're going to apply some of these principles in the particular case. And I very much am looking to see parties come to my Rule 16 conferences with a much more robust agenda and a much more informed view of how the particular issues of the case need to be managed under this new framework.
And I see a specific role for the magistrate judges Again, we are in that problem of getting judicial vacancies filled by congressional action, and that is leading to the declaration of judicial emergencies. Fortunately, the magistrate process of appointment is not subject and moves along very rapidly. So I think it's fair to say that in the period from at least 206 to the present, the amount of work done by the magistrates in this area was quite remarkable. Paul Grimm said that, in his view, having studied this, they were issuing about 70 to 75% of all the opinions in the area. So I would just tell counsel who are listening to this broadcast, if you don't know the magistrate judges, you're going to get to meet them very soon.
So the last question I was going to ask sort of came out of legal tech. I was reading some of the commentary on what people thought about legal tech, and there was this theme of proportionality tying back into vendors who have really the oftentimes the best handle on the unexpected costs of dealing with the data and reviewing it. So without endorsing any vendor in particular, since the court, with the exception of signing off on maybe a special master being brought in, is really seldom involved, and nor should they be involved with the selection of vendors. But since, you know, the vendors do have the most accurate information on project costs and e-discovery, how does the court see, you know, any change maybe in the role of vendors in helping to clarify proportionality concepts? And I'll throw that out to anyone.
Well, I one of the problems I've always had, I know Paul and Liz share this, is what vendors do has always been to me a bit of a black box. I mean, it is never explained to me, nor does it have to be in the cases I handle, what they were doing.
Can I clarify you? Because I have a great story on this that I tell lawyers all the time. We always get asked, what's this going to cost, with like two variables. Well, there's this many gigabytes, okay? Well, that doesn't matter if you know, completely. It depends on the level of, you know, analysis you're going to want on the data, and, you know, how many of them there are that actually require a lot of analysis. And I'm just trying to explain that when an estimate is given, it's usually given on completely incomplete information. And then the other challenge we have is we have no idea if the estimate's even accurate until we actually start the project. And that point in time, there's a discovery order already issued, more than likely. And I would just like to suggest that most of the knowledge on true costs happens after discovery starts. Everything before that is really a crystal ball and a guess, and a guess on incomplete information. I don't think clients appreciate that, and I don't know if the judiciary appreciates that, but that's the way the game is played.
Yeah.
I'm throwing that out there as an observation, but.
I think one important role for vendors who are supporting clients and parties and supporting counsel is to first and foremost insist upon an important role in gathering the facts and assembling the presentation of materials for the lawyers to the judge. In other words, I don't think it serves anyone's interest for the people with knowledge of the actual facts on the ground and what these things are likely to mean in terms of burden to play a subservient or secondary role. Now, whether that means actually participating in court hearings or signing declarations as part of the record that's submitted to the court, I think depends on a particular case. But there can be situations where I think that kind of firsthand knowledge is very important. And circling back to what we were talking about earlier, look, most judges in most cases just want to figure out what the facts are and get it right. And if any member of a team is best positioned to present those facts, I think the judge is going to benefit and really count on that member of the team stepping up and stepping forward with that information.
Well, and I would just say that it's not whether you're a vendor or whether something's done in-house. Some now corporations have some pretty sophisticated in-house operations, as I understand it. But wherever it is, whoever has the expertise, that should be used. And usually that's going to be, at least from a court hearing or appearance point of view, running in the background from our point of view. But often it's whoever is most knowledgeable should be talking to their counterpart on the other side, whether it's a vendor, whether it's an in-house person. having the IT people who know where things are and how to get them and what's a better way to do it is extremely important and often cuts through a lot of wasted time and speculation based on misunderstanding and smoke and mirrors. So it's whoever is the expert should be involved, whether it's meeting outside of the courtroom, feeding information to the lawyer, or appearing in the courtroom. That it all depends on what's going to be the most effective and cost-effective way to do that. But there are judges, and I'm not the first, I attribute it to other judges who talk about bring a geek to court. And if that geek happens to be the vendor who's the most knowledgeable, then so be it. If it happens to be somebody in-house, so be it. If it happens to be some associate in the outside law firm, so be it. It's let's get the facts. It's what we care about.
Absolutely right.
And the premise of this from a judicial point of view is the assumption that this is a competitive market, i.e. this vendor is competing with others and his price is at market value. That may or may not be true. So counsel should be sensitive to that and be able to say, Judge, I know the estimate on the other side is a bad amount of money, but in this market, that's way beyond what you could get those services done. And let me show you, I have here Mr. Smith who will explain that to you. I always worried when I handled these cases whether or not it was a competitive market and whether the lawyers had really shopped to get the best price.
Yeah, we saw that in some of the predictive coding decisions that came out. When prices were thrown out, you'd scratch your head and say, well, they could have done better. but anyway, so we've done two really good shows on sanctions and preservation with Judge Grimm, and we focus a lot of time on proportionality, which are the two big foundations in the new federal rules that I think everyone talks about. But in the last question, if anyone has any other rule that they think we haven't touched upon that they think is an important one or interesting, this would be the opportunity to get it into the podcast. And if any of you want to jump in and say add one, or if you're happy with these two being the focus.
I would add that the specific requirement, it's been in the case law but has been rarely adhered to, of making specific objections that aren't just boilerplate, and this we alluded to earlier, throwing out those forms, it's overbroad, irrelevant, I don't know what is means, et cetera, and all of which are just boilerplate that do absolutely nothing, and then keeping mysterious what, if anything, you're going to produce, leaving the other side to guess, that's over, and it's explicitly not allowed anymore, and I think that's a very important change.
I would agree with that, and really the only other change I would highlight that perhaps gets less attention in these discussions is the change to Rule 4M, which reduces to 90 days from 120 days the time for a plaintiff to serve the summons and complaint. And the reason why I highlight that is I really see that as a message to judges and parties and counsel that these cases need to move faster. They need to be quicker. Of course, in any given case, a judge should and often will consider extensions or additional time. But that I think, message about being prepared and ready to go sooner in a case is one that I think will play out in cases all over the country.
The only one I would add is the amendment to Rule 16 that permits the judge to put in his or her scheduling order an obligation to confer with the judge before filing a discovery motion. I appreciate that as the ordinary practice in most courts, certainly was in the district court where I was a magistrate judge, but that's an important point. And again, it's a very valuable tool for counsel to have. You can lay the groundwork for phone calls to the judge when things go wrong, and that's important.
And I think that caps a really neat show, and I'll just put out a quick commercial for the next show we're going to do. We're going to take an old judge, an old technologist and an old lawyer and ask, was it all worthwhile? We think it's 150 years of experience.
I take it that's an endorsement that none of us are old.
To the contrary, Your Honor, I'm on the show. So.
I don't agree with that.
You need to find somebody else.
Yeah, you want to listen in because I'm going to sing my way.
Oh my God! So that'll be a show, and we have a working title that probably won't appear on a heading, but it's the old fart to be discovery. The joke.
No, anyway. I hope not.
I'd like to thank you, Judge LaPorte and Judge Gruhl, for joining us, and Judge Facciola and myself today on ESI Bite. It's been a great show. And for the listeners, if you have any questions about this show or any other program at ESI Bite, please feel free to send me an email at my name, Carl, K-A-R-L, at inspiredreview.com. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of hosting ESI Bites. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. And as we always say here, ESI Bites, come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, President of Remote Review at Inspire Review, wishing you a nice day.